It's time for the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. This is John Williams. Pete Zimmerman is our producer. It's Thursday, so the weekly jobs report is sponsored by Breezy.hr, Breezy.hr. And joining us once again is Jared Dillian, the best-selling financial author. Visit JaredDillianMoney.com. Hi, Jared. Welcome back.
Hey, thank you.
Any surprises for you in those jobs numbers? Again, what do you think?
I don't think it really has any statistical significance. The weekly numbers are pretty volatile. You got to look at the four-week moving average. The four-week moving average is pretty much flat from month to month at about 385. So, you know, as long as we don't see a trend develop over the next couple months, I don't think there's anything to be alarmed about here.
Any idea what's going to happen when kids go back to school?
In terms of jobs?
Well, yeah, I wonder if actually that will be more of an incentive for people to go back to work.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, basically, you know, 400,000 on claims is really what we had throughout most of the Obama years from about 2010 to 2016. Claims were pretty stable at about 400,000. The problem is that the unemployment rate is 5.9%. And if we want to get that down, we need to be putting up claims numbers of about 300,000.
Any idea when that's going to happen?
Well, you know, like you said, maybe when kids go back to school. I actually hadn't thought about that, so that's a very good point.
Let's talk a little bit about something you wrote, too. Don't stiff the delivery guy. Why are you interested in the topic of tipping today?
Well, tipping is always of interest to me. You know, the difference between being a good tipper and a bad tipper really isn't that much. You know, if you went out to eat once a week and you tipped an extra $3, it comes out to $150 a year. It's not really money that you're going to miss. And, you know, especially if you live in a neighborhood and you go back to the same place all the time, I think you would want people to be happy to see you rather than to be sad to see you.
That's one way to put it. So you kind of broke it down to places you go to all the time, some of the times, et cetera, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a place, for example, you know, I live in Pawleys Island, South Carolina. There's a restaurant called Bistro 217. We go every week, and I'm a heavy tipper, and every single staff member in that restaurant comes by and says hello, you know, but generally we'll have a bill that's about $37, and I put down a 50, and we get great service. And I'm usually doing it after my radio show, so we get there late at night. We get there at about 9 o'clock, and they're closing up, and they let us eat.
So you're tipping $13 on a $37 bill, so you're tipping about 30% then, right?
Actually, more like 37, yeah.
And is that what you typically do? What if the bill was $98? Would you still tip 35, 40%?
Yeah, I might cut it back a little bit. You know, if you go out for an expensive steak dinner, two people and the bill is like $200. I may not give a 30 or 35% tip on that, but I'll at least do 25.
Yeah, you feel really, it is one way to feel super generous and super rich without it costing you a lot of money. If you get a coffee and a donut and it costs $4 and you give somebody 10. And I think a lot of us were doing stuff like that during the pandemic. I think people's generosity is sort of calmed down a little bit, you know?
Yeah, one idea that I have, and that is true, like people were doing that during the pandemic, but if you ever go into a place that has a tip jar, whether it's Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts or stuff like that, you know, I drive through a Dunkin' Donuts every day, and a lot of people will throw the change in the tip jar. They'll throw 30 cents in the tip jar, and they do the same thing every day. I don't do that, but about once a month, I'll put a 20 in the tip jar, which, you know, really gets people's attention. And then you get a lot better service.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to, I guess, look at it. Although some people don't like the idea of the tip jar at a place where you're doing all of the work. I know you didn't make the donut or the coffee, say, or whatever the meal is, but if you're walking up to the counter and carrying the food back to your table, then some people don't think there was any service. I did all of the work.
I think there's service anytime somebody has an opportunity to either be nice to you or to be not nice to you. So, we forget that people in a lot of these service positions, they're, you know, very low paid, certainly under $15 an hour, and every little bit helps. And, you know, what I like to think is, you know, the extra couple of bucks that I tip, if everybody did that over the course of the day, then they would have a pretty good day.
Let's talk about how you tip other people, other places. Uber, do you tip?
You know, I do tip Uber. I've had some bad experiences with Uber because I've tipped a driver, and then I've seen my passenger rating gone down after I've tipped him. So that causes me some consternation. But valets, the minimum tip for a valet is $5. The minimum tip for a porter is $5. If somebody's taking possession of your car, you know, this piece of equipment that costs $40,000, at a minimum, you have to give them $5.
Do you tip housekeeping when you stay in a hotel or motel?
I do, and I do it on the first night. And I'll take a $5 bill or a $10 bill, and I leave it on the pillow, and I never have any problems.
Coat check? Do you tip a coat check?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I've had some bad experiences with coat check. So, you know, I really like it when people, you know, I also have... Sometimes I have expensive clothes, so I always tip the coat check $5.
One last thing here. The all-time best way to make more money, something else you've written recently. You say it's obvious. Work longer, work more productively. What else? Oh, wait, you've got some other ideas here. Like, there are illegal ways to make money, and you also said sell platelets. Well, I don't want to do that, Jared.
No. No, I mean, you know, there's very linear ways to think about this. You know, a lot of people say, I want to get paid more, so I'm going to work longer hours, okay, which is definitely one way, or get a second job. That's definitely one way to make more money. But, you know, I like to be entrepreneurial, and my suggestion is to start a business.
Yeah.
And that's the best way to make more money.
Yeah, nobody's ever going to get rich when you're expecting somebody else to pay you. No one's going to pay you to get rich. If you want to get rich, you got to work for yourself. And I think that's something to keep in mind. Not that you need to be rich to be happy. But hands down, Jared Dillian says the best way to make money is start a business. JaredDillian.com is the website. We'll talk to you again soon. Thank you, Jared.
Okay, thanks.
The Wintrust Business Lunch continues. Ian Schur, the editor-at-large at CNET, joins us once again. Hi, Ian. Welcome back to the show.
How you doing?
Really good. Lots to talk to you about today. Let's sprint through some of these stories. Start by talking about Apple delaying their return to the office. Why and for how long?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Apple has been probably on the forefront of trying to push their employees back into the office. There's actually been a simmering debate in Silicon Valley about whether or not Apple forcing its employees to come back into the office 3 days a week starting in September made a lot of sense in this new age where a lot of the white-collar workers out there are working remotely now, and a lot of businesses are now starting to either allow employees to work remotely or going 100% remote themselves, one of them even getting rid of their corporate offices. But Apple internally has also just told their employees that their return to work plans are getting delayed a little bit. They're going to go into October, maybe longer, because of the rising rates of coronavirus and COVID infections around the country.
It's interesting. You think they could say we're all adults here. If you're vaccinated, you're probably going to be safe from the Delta variant. So I'm not surprised, but I suppose they could have just as easily gone the other way.
They could have. I think that reality is that there are a lot of people with kids at home who have to deal with, you know, the school environment and the school community. I'm in that boat myself. And even though I am vaccinated, I know also it only protects me some 90% of the time. And there are people who've gotten sick, not deadly, but sick, who had the vaccine. And so I don't want to be one of those people. I don't want to spread it through my school community. And I'm probably not alone.
What do you make of what the president said about Facebook killing and then not killing people?
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, back to the coronavirus, right? One of the interesting things that Facebook's been dealing with lately, and the government's gotten really frustrated, is that a lot of doctors recently have been coming out and saying that when they talk to patients who come into their offices or into the hospitals and talk about vaccines, the ones who are pushing back, almost every time they say they learned stuff from Facebook that told them why they shouldn't. And it is very clear Facebook has failed enormously to take care of the disinformation that is going around their platform. And it's spreading. And in a lot of ways, President Biden said, look, we are seeing rising rates of coronavirus. And on Friday last week, he said Facebook is killing people. Now, he's walked it back because it was a little hyperbolic, but the reality is that Facebook has failed to take care of these people who are spreading disinformation, and very much it's leading to harm. So, you know, a lot of people sat there and said, yeah, the president's cursed with telling the truth.
What is the solution? I mean, can Facebook police that?
The reality is that Facebook is not just a platform for you and I to post whatever we want. It is also an enormous soapbox. And the problem is that the way the computer systems work at Facebook is that the most aggressively negative stuff often gets the higher soapbox, because people interact with it.
Yep.
That is the problem. And so Facebook is not taking its part to make sure that the stuff that is blatantly lying about the coronavirus and the science behind it is not spreading. And that is really the problem.
Would it be that simple for them to notice the things that are getting the most reposts or the most comments and then reading them and then evaluating them? And if it's not true, taking them down? Is that feasible? Because that sounds like a lot of work also.
I wish it was that easy. That's the problem. I mean, we're talking about there are 3 billion people using Facebook every month. I can't even fathom how much has been posted in the last couple of seconds we've been talking. And look, there is something to be said for how hard this is. That said, Facebook made $9 billion with a B, billion dollars in profit last quarter. They could afford to hire a few more people to deal with this.
Speaking of billions, Jeff Bezos went up into space. Are you calling him an astronaut, by the way?
Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson at the Hayden Planetarium certainly isn't. You know, it's really funny to see this debate going on. Personally, I'm a space nerd. Like, I went to space camp. I still have the jumpsuit they gave me sitting in my closet somewhere. Like, I am a huge nerd for this stuff, and I was so happy to see SpaceX get people up to the ISS and seeing America fly again. That said, seeing billionaires go into spaces, you know, I'm jealous. I see why people are frustrated, right? They're billionaires who've made money off the backs of a lot of us. It's frustrating. At the same time, I'm excited about what commercial spaceflight can mean and whether or not it'll be really possible within my lifetime for me to go to space without paying an arm and leg for it. I'm pretty excited about that.
You can make the argument that a big question is it safe? I think a lot of people watched it not to see the thing go up and come down. It was a very short show in that case, but to just see if they manage it, kind of like the way you watch an IndyCar race. And
to your point, the fact that Jeff Bezos himself, right, the richest man in the world, for a moment the richest man in the universe, he was willing to get in the rocket himself, right? The first man's flight from that place. So it goes to show exactly your point. Part of this is them proving to all of us that they're willing to put their skin in the game, literally, to prove that these things are safe.
That's the point I'm trying to make, and I'm no fan of him or them going into space, but it's not just a vanity project then. It is him putting it's the courage of his convictions. He is actually going to risk it himself, and he'll go first to show everybody it's going to be okay.
Yeah, and look, for that, like I said, there's been a lot of talk over the years about how spaceflight can revolutionize the way that we move around the world. You know, a lot of people are worried about the impact of airplanes and jet fuel on the environment. This is a much safer, this is a much less environmentally destroying way of getting up into the air. It can move a lot quicker. It can get us across the globe a lot faster. If that stuff becomes normal, it can significantly help out a lot of these concerns we're worried about.
Ian Schur is the editor-at-large at CNET, CNET.com. Thanks, Ian. We always appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Take care.
Wintrust Business Lunch continues now with Greg McBride, Senior Vice President and Chief Analyst at Bankrate, a frequent guest on the show. Welcome back, Greg.
Good afternoon, John. Great to be with you again.
You guys are always surveying people and crunching some numbers. You have a survey about how ready Americans are to cover emergency expenses. What are the numbers these days?
You know, they're not really much improved. We had expected, you know, there's a lot of talk that Americans have in total more than $2 trillion in additional savings now that they didn't have pre-pandemic. But what we have found is that certainly does not fall evenly across the population. What we had found was a quarter of households have no emergency savings. That's consistent with what we've seen in years past. And at the other end of the spectrum, only a quarter, have enough to cover 6 months' worth of expenses. Did find that only about 1 in 6 households said that they had more emergency savings now than they did pre-pandemic. The surprising thing, John, was almost half said they have basically the same amount of emergency savings. So, you know, despite, you know, curtailments of spending for months on end, multiple rounds of stimulus checks, nearly half of households don't have any more emergency, no more, no less emergency savings relative to pre-pandemic.
It's surprising to me. I thought that everybody was saving. Obviously, a lot of people aren't making money right now. There's unemployment still high. But then again, the government is subsidizing some of that. I thought that the numbers would change. That, in fact, haven't our savings patterns changed during the pandemic?
The prioritization of it has definitely ramped up. We've saw that in the last recession as well, where it was serves as a bit of a wake-up call, and all of a sudden people realize, oh, you know what? I really do need more money in savings, and I know that I'm behind and I've got work to do. What we had noticed coming out of the financial crisis is that despite that widespread recognition, the needle just didn't move very much despite a decade-long economic expansion. So, you know, we're seeing that that same recognition that people say, I know I need more, I know I don't have enough, and I've got some work to do. The challenge is going to be moving the needle. And so far, we just haven't seen that needle move. Where it's moved have been households that tended to already have a pretty healthy cushion to begin with.
Yeah, it sounds like the K-curve all over again, doesn't it? The people on the bottom half are still down or going down, and the people on the top half were actually prospering or saving more money during the pandemic.
That's exactly it. You hit the nail on the head. That K-shaped consumer recovery that we've heard about representing the disparate fortunes of various households. And yes, higher income households far more likely to have boosted their savings, far more likely to be feeling comfortable with their savings. You know, on the other hand, 34% of households have less emergency savings now than they did pre-pandemic. And that's consistent with what we had found in other polls earlier this year, where more than 40% of households had suffered an income disruption at some point during the pandemic. You could see why. They would need to lean on their savings during that period of time and may well have run that down considerably.
So 25% of households report having no savings at all, and another 26% say they have less than 3 months of expenses covered in some sort of emergency account. So over half of us then are unable to withstand a shortfall for 3 months or more. That's discouraging. It's not all surprising, but it's a little interesting to see that the habits haven't changed that much. I wonder, or at least the economics haven't changed that much. I wonder if people are learning lessons, though, right? Well, maybe when we all get back to work, we will start to save better. Do you have any expectation for that?
I'm hopeful, but, you know, I kind of, I'll be honest, had those hopes coming out of the financial crisis, especially when we saw attitudes shift so dramatically, and yet there was really not a lot of progress seen for a number of years. Now, the added ingredient there was we had stagnant wage growth in many income brackets for much of that economic expansion, and that really held that back. We are seeing wage growth now, particularly at the lower ends of the wage spectrum. That gives me some hope that you will see more people starting to put money away. We had seen throughout the stimulus checks, the predominant uses of the stimulus checks were paying day-to-day essentials and monthly bills. But what kind of crept up with each additional round of stimulus, we noticed more and more people would say they were going to use it to pay down debt or boost savings. So those additional rounds of stimulus certainly helped a lot of households steady the ship and then take a step forward in terms of their financial progress.
We're talking to Greg McBride from Bankrate. Are people using credit cards more then? Are they putting some of these costs on credit?
Not that we can see in terms of revolving balances. Credit card usage is up, but a lot of that's just because spending activity is up. Things have opened up. People are going out. They're able to go to the Cubs game, the type of things that couldn't happen in 2020. And so there's a lot more activity being charged on the cards. But what we had seen a very dramatic decline in throughout the pandemic in the last year and a half was credit card balances went down very significantly. People were paying down debt. They weren't spending as much. Now that the spending's ramping up, it's going to take a little time to see whether or not that's translating into higher debt levels.
That may be what I was thinking of, though, right? Because I thought people were saving more. You said, well, maybe not so, but I suppose paying down something that's 25% interest is a pretty good form of savings as well.
That's a pretty good risk-free return, absolutely. If you do have high-cost debt, there is a tremendous sense of urgency to get that paid off as quickly as possible because of that very high interest cost.
Greg McBride, Senior Vice President. He's the Chief Analyst at Bankrate. The website's bankrate.com. Thanks again, Greg. We appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, John.
Wintrust Business Lunch Business News continues. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The median price of homes sold in the Chicago area is up double digits. June was the 11th consecutive month of big gains. Illinois Realtors says $319,000 was the median price of homes sold in the nine-county metropolitan area. That's an increase of 20.4% compared to a year ago, and the biggest monthly gain in the group's data going back to January 2008. In Chicago, $351,500 was the median price of homes sold in June, up 6.8% from June of 2020. McDonald's says it's increasing its purchasing with diverse owned suppliers to 25% by 2025. The current level's at 23%. The company committed to new diversity goals in the aftermath of the police killing of George Floyd. McDonald's is also asking companies it does business with to commit to making similar diversity moves. Beef producer Cargill and chicken processor Tyson Foods have already signed on to the pledge. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you, sir. Now it's the business of food, and it's Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. Here's a voice I know you'll recognize.
Summer is here, and yes, the McHenry County Fair returns August 3rd through the 8th.
McHenry County resident Big O, who's had a long history with that fair, not as long as the fair's been around, though.
We've been around since 1854.
That's Rich Tobias, the vice president of the McHenry County Fair.
We're now in our 72nd year on Country Club Road in Woodstock.
Last year was COVID, but the fair's back with a lot of new attractions.
Horse and tractor pulls, monster trucks, bull riding, and the Sunday Demo Derby includes, of all things, a combine demo derby.
Wait, a combine demo derby?
They start in four corners of the arena, and then they kind of go at it when the green flag drops.
Okay. County fairs are really a special time for 4-H'ers and FFA'ers, aren't they?
Well, there's competition for the best of show and plaques, and that's the goal of 4-H'ers and open farm shows. But there's also things like jams and jellies and cakes and sewing, flowers, veggie competitions, and all you can eat, sampling fair food of every type imaginable.
So no danger of anybody going hungry out there, huh?
Oh, absolutely not. No chance. Yeah, you can start with a hearty 4-H breakfast, have a corn dog and a funnel cake on the midway for lunch, and then enjoy a cattleman's steak sandwich with baked potato and sweet corn for dinner. Yeah. I'd finish off the day with a hand-dipped ice cream cone from a farm bureau, though.
And what if I want to have somebody try to guess my weight after eating all of that?
We've got the midway. They've got all kinds of booths and carnival rides for the whole family. And I guess the best part of it, it doesn't cost an arm and a leg for a day filled with family fun.
Rich Tobias of the McHenry County Fair. Parking is free. And tickets? Yeah, take us home, Big O.
Visit McHenryCountyFair.com.
Thank you, Orion. At the Chicago Board of Trade, some profit-taking going on earlier in the session. Double-digit losses all across the board. It's eased up a little, but still, beans are down 21 cents. Corn is off about a nickel right now. And wheat is trading down about 19 and a quarter cents. The Merck hogs are off a dollar today. Feeder and live cattle are trading up about $1.50. Today is National Mango Day and also National Panucci Fudge Day. That's the light-colored fudge made with brown sugar. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
So I thought we already did this story, Amy Guth. It says here General Motors is shutting down most of its pickup production for a week. I thought they had already done something like that. Am I mistaken here?
Well, you're partly right. Ford has done something similar. All automakers are really struggling with the chip shortage, but GM now is saying they are going to join that. So starting Monday, they're going to the plants will be dark for a week. We'll see if it goes beyond that. Ford has done some rolling kind of blackouts of their factories of different weeks staggering throughout this month, and then they decided to they're going to look ahead to August and see what happens beyond that. But yeah, so GM has joined the ranks there, and it's really all about pickup trucks and big SUVs. That's such a profitable vehicle for all automakers. GM had said they were even trying not to take this route and taking chips from less popular vehicles, cars that don't sell quite as many as SUVs and trucks, just to get the truck production done. But ultimately, they did have to do this, even though they were certainly trying to avoid that.
Man, you'd think that the chip shortage would be resolved by now. Who's not making enough of these things? I wonder what the holdup is, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot of supply. A lot of people are asking the same questions about supply chains. Now, as we're seeing this Delta variant rise and we're seeing some restrictions starting to come back into place for health and safety measures, a lot of industry watchers are kind of speculating that this might actually keep this going and make it even more chaotic in a time when the supply chains are already pretty chaotic. So I'll be watching that really closely to see just what happens in the next few weeks, because I agree with you. It seems like this would have started to, we'd start to see a little bit of the pressure easing up, not just the chip shortage, but with other areas of supply chain. But I think the next couple of weeks will probably be pretty critical for that.
McDonald's is buying from a more diverse crowd. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There was a bit of this on the Wintrust Business Minute just a bit ago that listeners perhaps heard. But so McDonald's has committed to buying their supplies from more diverse owned suppliers. So to kind of break that down in numbers, they spent $14 billion throughout the U.S. supply chain in 2020. 23% of that was from diverse owned suppliers. So what they're saying is they're going to go up to 25%. So it's only just a couple of percentage points. But what that means for in McDonald's money, a couple of percentage points, that translates into this new goal would bring spending with diverse owned firms to about $3.5 billion a year. So that's the latest that they're doing. They've rolled out a few different diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. And so this is the latest. They're also working with their suppliers, asking them to meet them with that, and also to, take a look at their hiring practices and their leadership and who works for them and how diverse their workforce is.
Rivian, the electric vehicle manufacturer, has got another plant going up, huh?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I think a lot of industry watchers are kind of buzzing about this one today. And this is an exclusive report that Reuters had earlier today, that Rivian is planning to have a second U.S. assembly plant. It will also include battery cell production, and that is according to some people attached to that matter that spoke to Reuters. It's unclear where exactly it will be. It's been shrouded in a little bit of secrecy. It's already been delayed once. It was going to be happen earlier this summer, but that was delayed. But they're hoping to announce it in the next month or two, and then break ground very early next year. Mm-hmm. They have, we keep a close eye on Rivian around here just because they have their plant in Normal, Illinois, that used to be a Mitsubishi plant. They took that over. And they're producing the Rivian vehicles from there. So I think it'd be very interesting to see where that is. At the time, they talked about Normal being, such a key place to being a very central location and to having easy access to Detroit automakers and things like that. But we shall see whether the other plant will be. There's a lot of speculation, but who knows where it'll end up.
Well, it'd be nice if it stayed in Central Illinois. Abbott beats revenue expectations.
That's right. And so Abbott has beat their revenue expectations for the second quarter. And if you think what was happening in the second quarter, we saw COVID tests or COVID case numbers starting to decline. And so Abbott was making a lot of money off their rapid COVID test product. So while the revenue from testing products was $1.3 billion, that was down from $2.2 billion in the first quarter. There, something else happened at the same time. If you recall earlier in the pandemic, a lot of routine medical procedures were not happening. They were being delayed. Abbott makes a lot of medical devices and products that are included in a lot of routine medical care. So as their test supply numbers, that revenue was going down, their products for routine medical care and pharmaceuticals for kind of everyday ailments, that was going up pretty rapidly. So they were able to beat some expectations in their second quarter profit and revenue results.
I was going through my stuff, my place the other day, and I found myself throwing out some masks that I thought, well, I'm not going to need these anymore. Not the disposable ones, but some of the ones that were cloth, and I thought, you know, I'm not going to wear these anymore. I'll keep the disposable ones in case I need them. They haven't been used yet. But the ones you would wash, I thought, I'm not going to ever need these again. And now I'm not so sure if, in fact, that whole industry isn't going to have a second coming here, you know?
Yeah, I think it will be interesting to see how mask usage goes, just even in like your average cold and flu season. Now that we know we can deal with masks, I think it will be interesting to see if people maybe use those in the winter when they're going out in public or when they're maybe have the sniffles and they just want to kind of protect their coworkers, things like that. But I've been thinking about that too. My mom made me a bunch of really pretty masks. So I'm like, well, what am I going to do with these when all this is over?
I actually thought about keeping a couple of them, not for old time's sake, but they will be interesting reminders. You go, what's this Chicago Cubs mask, Grandpa? And I'll say, right. Well, you know, in 2020, there was this terrible thing, and we all had these things, and so we started to make them at least feel personal to us. So they had all kinds of logos, and they'd match your shoes if you were lucky. And then I thought, that time has passed. Now I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I'm right there with you on that. It will be, I think, very interesting to see what happens in the next several weeks and month ahead.
And there was also the story about businesses that were Hartshaftner Marks that make suits in Chicago. Early in the pandemic run, they shifted, since people weren't going to work and buying suits, they started making masks. And the first one I had was a Hartshaftner Marks face mask. I wonder if businesses, the same way a lot of them pivoted to making hand sanitizer, think Whiskey Acres in the DeKalb area. They continued to make bourbon, but they started to also make hand sanitizer. Then they stopped. I just wonder if these businesses are going to see sort of a second coming of their secondary, you know, their side hustles, if you will.
That's actually a very good idea. I think that would be interesting to call around to a few businesses and just see, because so many, exactly like you said, so many businesses kind of pivoted and started making masks. Even like on Etsy, there were people doing totally unrelated things that started making kind of custom masks and very fancy ones. That's interesting. I may have to do a little digging on that for you.
Another day. Thank you, Amy Guth.
Thanks so much.